In brightest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light!
Welcome to the debut episode of Green Lantern's Light. My name is Michael Bradley, and with me are my co-ringslingers, Jeffrey Taylor and J. David Weider.
Hello, I'm Jeffrey
Hello.
Taylor.
I'm J. David Weider.
The premise of this podcast is about as simple as you're going to find. We are here to talk a whole lot about Green Lantern. It's very possible, if you're listening to this, that you're familiar with one or more of us from our other podcasting and internet endeavors. But for the benefit of those who aren't familiar, let's go around and just briefly introduce ourselves and mention the other shows that we're involved in. Jeffrey, you want to go first?
Well, I'm part of the From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, which is presented by the Superman homepage, where every episode my co-host Michael Bailey and I discuss, at this point, half a month in the life of the Superman comics published from 1986 to 2006. We're nearing the end of 1992, which means that I think we're about a dozen or so episodes away from the actual death. But that's my other main podcasting thing. You can also find my articles on the Superman homepage, and I have a biweekly column about the upcoming Superman movie on movies.com.
And I am J. David Weider. I used to host Superman Forever Radio, but now I write a blog called Dave's Amazing World of Superman, which you can find at amazingworldofsuperman.com, which is pretty much a potpourri of Superman through my eyes. And on the Marvel side of things, I host Pad Smash, an Incredible Hulk podcast, which looks issue by issue through the entire Peter David era of the Incredible Hulk from 1987 to 1998. I'm also a host on the Walking Dorks podcast, which you can find at thewalkingdorks.com. And finally, I write the Vintage Viewpoint column at Simply DCU at simplydcu.wordpress.com.
As for myself, my name is Michael Bradley, and I host The Thrilling Adventures of Superman, which you can find at greatkrypton.com. That's a show where I'm going through all of Superman's Golden Age adventures in the various media and kind of exploring through the history and development of the character. As we're recording this, I'm currently in the beginning of early 1940, and I rotate through the comics and the newspapers and the radio show pretty much in chronological order. And while it's on hiatus, I also co-host Legends of the Batman with my friend Michael Kaiser, where we're taking a similar approach to Batman. But as for this show, this is going to be a monthly podcast, and we're planning on covering a couple months' worth of books each episode. Our focus is going to be on the very late Bronze Age and post-crisis Green Lantern stories, beginning with Green Lantern number 172 from 1983. That issue is the start of the Len Wein, Dave Gibbons run on the title. And while their run only lasts a little more than a year, it really sets up a lot of things that come afterward when Steve Englehart and Joe Staton take over. And when we say Green Lantern, we're talking about Hal Jordan, John Stewart, Guy Gardner, and the Green Lantern Corps. We probably will not be covering Alan Scott stories on this show. At the point in time that we're starting, Alan made very few appearances outside of All-Star Squadron and Infinity Inc., and those are all being covered very well by Michael Bailey and Scott Gardner on Tales of the JSA. We really don't want to tread over them, so we're just going to stick with the Green Lantern Corps. And really, they're two separate entities anyway. While 172 is a good starting point, we realize that it isn't ground zero. So this episode, we have picked out three stories from Green Lantern history that introduce key characters or concepts in the mythology, and we're going to talk about those. I'd say most people listening to this are familiar with the basics, but we really thought doing this would be a fun way to kick off the show and let us look back before moving forward.
We'll get into the meat next time. For right now, enjoy your salad.
Right. Before we get into that, though, let's take a bit more time and go around the table and kind of tell our history with the character and what we like about the concept. David, let's start with you, and then over to Jeffrey and back to me.
Okay. Well, I got into comics in general at an early age via Super Friends, and that's where I was first introduced to Green Lantern. I just thought he had a great concept, a great look. He was my first superpowers figure. But I didn't get into the mythology until later, because walking into the comics in the early to mid 80s, which we're actually covering with the core, Guy Gardner, John Stewart, that's a hard leap from Super Friends. Super Friends had it very watered down.
Yeah.
But I was drawn to him because he had the same paradigm and of the standard superhero that you see, but at the same time, there was an entire wing to his tapestry as well. So he could be a straightforward superhero, but his backdrop is Star Trek, Star Wars, Dune, sometimes Doctor Who, all rolled into one. And while that's intimidating, it's also incredibly fascinating. So my actual entry was more getting some of the tidbits through Justice League International, through Guy Gardner and Nort, and it kind of started helping flesh out that idea. And I think I really managed to get into it and feel competent about the stories with Green Lantern number 25. That's where Hal took his sector back from Guy Gardner. And that's also when I got my first Green Lantern ring, because if you remember the plastic promos that were sent out with the glow-in-the-dark center?
I vaguely remember those.
Okay, they were ridiculously oversized, but that was my first Green Lantern ring, and I was kind of hooked from there. And from there on, it was spotty because I was in and out of comics, but around the time that Kyle came into the picture, I was on the books for quite a while, and I'd been with the books since Hal returned. And that's where Geoff Johns kind of fleshed out and extended the mythology even more. But I like that he, as I mentioned, he has that superhero side, but he's also a cop. He's a member of a corps where, you know, it's a duty to do this. They have rules. And I like him being sort of the James Kirk character who kind of bucks that and gets the job done every now and then anyway, as far as Hal goes. And John, we're going to talk about John a little bit later, but yeah, that's generally my entry point.
So on to me, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Well, my fascination with Green Lantern, it's funny because I can talk up and down about how I got into Superman. I could do an hour-long episode about it. In fact, I probably have. But with Green Lantern, it's quite a bit different, because the first Green Lantern comic book that I ever read was issue 48 out of, I guess that would have been volume 3. It came out in 1993. And that's the beginning when Hal Jordan is trying to recreate Coast City, which has been destroyed during the reign of the Supermen. Mm-hmm. And gets, you know, a slap on the wrist from the Guardian saying, "You can't do that. That's not what the ring is for. You're wasting the energy," or something to that effect. And he gets really mad. And then in the next issue, he goes and kills a bunch of Corps members, which was my first time ever meeting a lot of those members and then seeing them die brutally. Followed by, you know, the big fight with Sinestro, the killing of the Guardians, and then him disappearing, and the next thing you know, Kyle Rayner is Green Lantern, and that was my Green Lantern for a long time, was Kyle Rayner. But I always had this fascination with Hal Jordan, especially with the way that things had ended with him, that I really did want to backtrack and see what made this character and what was different about Hal Jordan. Even though, I mean, Kyle Rayner was still my guy. He was still the one that I probably paid the most attention to, at least until Rebirth, although I do still pay attention to Kyle. Still not big on the whole Ion story, but oh well. And so actually going back and learning more and more about Hal Jordan, I discovered that I had an affinity for this character as well, and I really did like what Geoff Johns did with Ethan Van Sciver with Green Lantern Rebirth, and the way that they brought everything forward from there, basically reimagining everything that was the universe. But it's really nice to be able to look back and see what was that universe before anyway, where there weren't a series of different colors. You basically had the green and there was a yellow. And well, technically there was a Star Sapphire too, but you didn't have a huge myriad of colors. And in fact, I don't think that it needed it, because there was so much good storytelling. And especially when you get into a lot of the core members that were introduced starting at around 1983, I think it did a lot for me. And of course, before I even got into Hal Jordan, somebody I had traded a whole bunch of baseball cards for basically Green Lantern Mosaic numbers 1 and 3 through 18. I was missing issue 2 for a long, long time. But that was my introduction to John Stewart, who we're also going to end up talking about quite a bit.
When you backtracked and read those older Hal Jordan stories, did it change your view of Emerald Twilight any?
I suppose so, because going into it that way, it's going to be a completely different experience than if you actually were reading from, I don't know, from the beginning or from the 1980s. Because it does do something to the character. And in fact, that was one of my biggest problems with Rebirth to begin with, which is something we're not going to talk about pretty much ever. But or if we do, it's way, way down there. So yeah. I can go ahead and throw this out there now. I really hated at first that they made it so that Hal Jordan could be forgiven. Because basically you can take all this stuff that Parallax was and sort of forgive Hal Jordan in a way.
Right.
Now, the thing about that is that you still have to put him at fault for allowing the fear to overtake him.
True. Batman didn't forgive him.
Not for a while, no.
Not until Infinite Crisis, really.
Yeah, I'm for some reason thinking of the Brave and the Bold number 1 when they teamed up and they had like a quick little quip about it, but then it was over.
True. But he didn't really get back into trusting him as a teammate until Infinite Crisis. It was the last issue. Was that 6 issues?
Infinite Crisis was 7 issues.
7 issues. Issue number 7, where Hal comes flying in from while Batman's in the OMAC satellite.
But here's a character who what he did was so bad he had to be redeemed like 3 times. they redeemed him in not even just what he did in Green Lantern 50. But also what he eventually did in Zero Hour, which I don't want to get too much into. I don't want to spoil that for anybody. Never mind, I just did. But then he gets redeemed at the end of Final Night, and then he sort of gets redeemed during Day of Doom or Day of Judgment? Day of Judgment. So yeah, he had to be redeemed like 4 times because what he had done was so bad. But before that, he was a good guy. And that's what we're really going to be focusing on for a good long time.
Right. Well, as for myself, being a child in the 80s, I too grew up watching Super Friends and playing with my Superpowers action figures. It's odd, I don't really have any solid memories of Hal on Super Friends, and I can only explain that as my attention was too much on Superman and Batman. But I like the character, and I have vivid memories of playing with my Superpowers action figure, and he wasn't the – I don't know if he was the first figure I got. I kind of figure he wasn't, but he is one of my favorite figures from that line. But as I've gotten older and read more comics, I've really grown to like the concept of Green Lantern and the characters. And I'm sure part of that is because it's very much in the mold of Superman, but with enough twists to make it unique. You know, you've got the brave and moral upstanding hero, and you've got the love triangle, but neither of those are – carbon copies of Superman. I mean, with the love triangle, it was originally Hal loves Carol and Carol loves Green Lantern and Hal can't tell her that he's Green Lantern. But since then, it's changed and evolved and, it's got its own twists with Carol being Hal's boss and she's also Star Sapphire and then in the 70s, at some point, she learned that Hal was Green Lantern.
I think that's interesting because I actually really like the love triangle. But I mean, I also liked it in Superman. But on the other hand, that does get old and stale pretty quickly.
Right. Well, when you keep relying on it for stories, it gets old. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I like Hal too because to me, he's a stand-up guy. Yes, he's cocky and self-assured, or he's been written that way at times. But at the end of the day, it's that same self-assuredness that lets him point to the ground and say, "There's the line. You don't cross it." And I really like that in my heroes. Heroes that understand, like they say, there's a right and a wrong in the universe, and that distinction is not very difficult to make. And the larger mythology of the Green Lantern Corps in general, there's just so much you can do with it and so many stories you can tell. Because at any given point, you've got 3,600 Green Lanterns, or today it's 7,200. And that doesn't even take into account the past Green Lanterns that have been killed or died. And each of those can have their own unique personality and point of view, so there's just a lot of storytelling potential there. And even given the hundreds of lanterns that have been introduced over the years, I don't think they've still yet to do more than really scratch the surface on it.
Well, no, the universe is a big place.
Right.
Yeah.
And on that note, you know, even just taking one Green Lantern character like Hal Jordan, there's just so much you can do. I mean, you can tell stories of Hal bopping around Coast City and stopping sonar, or you can stick him in outer space for a big galaxy-spanning epic, or you can make it into a smaller story still set in space that's more like a police drama. So I just think there's a lot of potential stories you can tell with Green Lantern and the Green Lantern characters.
And the best ones take all of them and wrap them up in bacon.
What?
You take all those stories and wrap it up in something that's even awesomer.
Okay. Okay.
And then you get one really big story. Because, come on, what's more awesome than bacon?
Even vegetarians have problems with bacon. Oh, okay, yeah, that fell down. Okay. Never mind that noise, folks.
Plus, Hal Jordan is a test pilot. And when you're 7 years old, that's freaking cool. I mean, with no slight to either character, a test pilot is a lot cooler than a reporter or a Wall Street playboy. So.
Yeah, that was one of the things that Darwin Cook was saying when he, after he'd written Justice League, well, not Justice League, The New Frontier, but DC, The New Frontier. And he mentioned it again when the Justice League, New Frontier DVD came out. That there's nothing cooler than being a test pilot. But then he gets like the crappiest part of the test pilot jobs, like, okay, get in this pod and we're gonna splash you down 100 times.
So what are you guys looking forward to on the show besides the basic premise of going through the stories?
Well, I'll jump in and just be flat out honest. There's a fair amount in here that I have not read. I've read probably half of it. And I really like what I have read, and I wanted an excuse to go back and read it. And when you guys said, hey, I want to do a Green Lantern podcast, I said, there's my excuse.
Because you have to have a podcast to read comics.
That's not funny. Yeah. It's true.
It helps.
I'm kind of with Jeffrey. I haven't read a lot of it because my run was a little bit later. So it's going to be cool to see certain things like Aresia and her development. Pun intended.
Yeah, I was going to say pun intended. Okay.
But yeah, those relationships building, you know, from where I would enter the books later down the road.
It's weird. I'm kind of on the same page as you guys. Not so much with Hal, but with John Stewart and Guy Gardner. I've not read just all too many of their early stories, even though I'm familiar with their modern incarnations. So I'm excited to be able to, you know, revisit some stories that I like and experience some that I've never read and see the early days of, you know, John Stewart and Guy Gardner.
But, and here I was hoping that one of you two would like be the expert and that I can just be the wisecracking guy. But that's just what we have on From Crisis to Crisis.
So, like I said, this episode we've picked out three stories to go over as a quick primer to the mythology. And Jeffrey's got the first one, so I'm going to turn it over to him.
First up, we're going to backtrack to Green Lantern number one, which had a cover date of July to August 1960, was released May 24th, 1960, long before I was born anyway. Original cover price, 10 cents. The editor here was Julius Schwartz, writer John Broom, specifically of the story we're about to discuss, penciler Gil Kane, inker Murphy Anderson, and this cover was by Gil Kane and Joe Giella. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And so this one is called Green Lantern, The Planet of Doomed Men. And I do want to start out by saying this was not the first appearance of Hal Jordan, but basically there's no reason for us to have to go back to that. I would think it was in Showcase number 22, because that story is basically told in this Green Lantern number one, and this one really expands upon it. This was reprinted in Secret Origins number one, yet oddly Showcase 22 was reprinted in Secret Origins number two. Don't know what to say about that. It was
really
also
like the origin, I think.
Yeah. They also put him with the Supergirl first appearance and the origin of the Atom. I know because we just got one in at the comic shop where I work. It was also reprinted in the DC Blue Ribbon Special Blue Ribbon Digest number 4, Green Lantern Archives Hardcover, Volume 1. Secret Origins Replica Edition number 1, Showcase Presents Green Lantern Volume 1, Green Lantern: The Greatest Stories Ever Told, Green Lantern Chronicles Volume 1, and the Green Lantern Omnibus. So this is reprinted all over the place. If you can't find it, you didn't look hard enough. So getting into the main story, we have this opening splash page of Green Lantern Hal Jordan fighting some sort of a large, fuzzy alien with a mohawk. Whose name is Drigg. Or is it Drigg? I'm going to go with Drigg. But the basic story, Hal Jordan is flying his jet because he is a test pilot, and he suddenly has a brain fart. But what's really happened is the Guardians, they're just called the Guardians here, not the Guardians of the Universe. Or they're just called the Guardians. And they summon his astral form or energy self, something to that effect, to appear in front of him. And all this is happening in the blink of an eye on Earth. So he's perfectly fine. He's not going to crash this thing. And they basically remind him, yes, we know that you are a Green Lantern and you've never met us. We are the Guardians. And then we have this little backstory about Abin Sur, how he was the one who gave Hal the ring because he was in a ship that was outside of Earth. And the yellow sunlight from our sun made the ship crash. That's what? Right. Yellow sunlight.
That's kind of reverse from what we're used to.
Yeah. Let's see. It was on page 7. They kind of go back and forth to it, which is the only reason I didn't write this all down. Instead, I'm just winging it on this one. So in this flashback, Hal Jordan is in some sort of a dummy jet that's supposed to be shaking him around to simulate flight, essentially. And that thing gets picked up off the ground and goes over to where Abin Sur's ship has crashed. Abin Sur explains who he is, that he's a Green Lantern, that he's dying. And he gives Hal Jordan the ring, tells him about saying the oath, that the charge will only last 24 hours. All that good stuff. And also about how he crashed. Again, they did go into a bit of a strange order on this. So yes, he becomes Green Lantern, and then we go back to where his astral form is in front of the Guardians. Now, the astral form is something that we're going to see a little bit of really early on. And the Guardians basically says, yes, now you know of our existence, but we're going to wipe your memory clean so that you don't know that we exist, because that would be bad somehow. He already knows about aliens. He's already basically made first contact. No, well, Superman's been around, so never mind. And so as soon as they send him back, they say, you know what? We should warn him about this really big, great danger. That's right. That's too bad. He was just here, wasn't he? We could have told him, but we already wiped his memory. Okay. So they end up talking to him through the lantern. I think the lantern has actually talked to him before this.
Yes.
So that it's explained that actually is the Guardians talking to him, and the Guardians then tell him that even though he's on his way to a date with Carol Ferris, he has to put his ring on, charge it up, and go to a planet in a neighboring solar system and solve their problem, which he says, yes, of course I will do that. Puts on his suit, charges the ring, goes off, and he gets to this other planet where there are these very jaundiced looking people. It would be really unfortunate if Hal had to use the ring on them because they are yellow. But they are thankful that he's there. They've been praying to this tree that somebody would come and help them. And in fact, that's exactly what Hal Jordan is there to do. And there's this giant furry creature with a mohawk called Drigg. This is his only appearance, so we'll go ahead and say, hey, first appearance of Drigg. And Hal has a really hard time putting him down. He uses his, you know, ring beam, and it doesn't seem to do anything. Does not penetrate its skull, its skin, anything. So he forms a nozzle as a construct from his ring, and uses liquid oxygen, which he somehow creates with the ring, I'm thinking. I don't really know. And is able to freeze Drigg in this giant ice cube. But obviously that's not going to be good enough, because eventually he'll melt, he'll come back out. So he picks it up and puts it on the frozen ice cap, where he will hopefully stay frozen forever and ever. Goes back to where all these yellow guys are, and they say, Guma, come on! As in thank you, somehow. So Hal goes back to Earth and hopes that he's going to be back in time for his date with Carol.
David, you want to go first with your notes?
Yeah, sure. You mentioned that, the Lantern has been talking to Hal this whole story kind of flat. It's almost a retake. Obviously, we have the origin redone from Showcase 22, but it's also kind of a rehash of a story in Showcase 23. It's called Summons from Space, and just replace the gorilla thing with a yellow pterodactyl creature, and it's pretty much beat for beat. He gets the summons, wonders who's on the other side of the battery, goes to Venus this time, and traps the indigenous species in a cave. But if you were going to remove the three showcase appearances altogether and just start from here, this would be a good start to an introduction to the character. I don't want it to sound like I'm bashing it, but pages 5 and 6, the synchronicity with Showcase 22 is astounding. These are all completely redrawn panels. Completely done, but if you look at it beat for beat and put them side by side, even though they're different angles, different looks, the word balloons are still exactly the same. It's perfectly in place, panel by panel. So it's actually really well done.
I like that it was so, you know, they didn't just lift the same artwork and stick it in the story, but they kept it the same.
Well, quick question. In the Showcase 22 version, is Hal wearing loafers with no socks?
Is he? I don't know if it even. No, he's wearing socks here. I can see him on page 5.
I don't know. That looks like ankle to me.
A gray ankle?
Well, he's not military. Never mind. As I say, if it's military issue, they'd be dark socks. But yeah, those are socks.
Okay. They're very thin socks. I think he's wearing tights.
Well, I mean, some people like to wear tights under their flight costume. But no, the synchronicity is really, really good, even though, and they could have gone lazy, like you said, Michael. They could have just lifted that art, slapped it in there, and saved themselves a few bucks. But this was actually really good production. And one other thing, the ring doesn't put the costume on him yet. I mean, later on, we're going to see he just fires up the ring and he's in costume. Here, he's actually physically pulling the costume on.
Leaving Abensur's naked body in the desert, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's that. Yeah. I didn't connect those two.
Well, he's not using it.
Waste not, want not. I did that backwards. On page 11, did we need an editor's note to tell us what just happened a few pages ago? Green Lantern is unaware that the person on the other side of his energy duplicate has already visited the Incredible Guardians. Yeah, I know. I was there.
Right. 3 pages ago.
Maybe that was done before they decided that they needed to flesh it out with the original story. Who knows? I mean, do we really need a little note at the bottom of page 8 saying that the story is continued on the third page following, or can't we just figure that out by skipping the ads?
touche. I was actually kind of a surprised and annoyed at the way the ring translated, because apparently that's not audible. It's text. Because if you look at the thought balloon, it appears in the green beam, which implies to me that he's reading the word Drig.
Yeah, the ring is actually saying, and that second to last panel on page 11, the ring is actually translating for him, but the translation is coming directly out of the ring instead of coming from the person, the alien that he's talking to.
Yeah. Which, I mean, we know they have universal translators, but I always thought it was automatic.
Right.
Kind of like in Star Trek. Is you just hear what that person's saying in your language.
It's like having a Babel fish.
Yes. Except you don't have to put anything in your ear. Here's what annoyed me with the story, though. Green Lantern takes Drig, freezes him, and puts him at the polar ice cap. This is an indigenous species. This is not a Green Lantern emergency. This is nature happening. I mean, this is almost like on Star Trek, if them violating the Prime Directive.
Drig could be an alien.
True. I mean, we don't get the full scale of how he ended up there, just that he is there. But I read it as, oh, you're right, because if he was an alien, the cavemen type people would be a little bit more prepared. That would be a way of life for them. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I meant alien to them.
Sure, maybe he wandered from another. Okay. I just, you know, PETA would not like this book. But that's all I've got on that as far as page to page. It was a decent story. It had that Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon kind of feeling.
It does. I agree with that. I mean, yeah. It kind of made me think of, you know, similar sci-fi and alien stories from this time as well as before and after.
Yep. But that's all I've got.
But I liked it more because it's Green Lantern.
Yeah.
I'll go next. I really don't have too many notes since we're just kind of reflecting on this for the origin, but I forget if Jeffrey or David said it, but Hal had 6 appearances prior to this, 3 issues of Showcase, and then alongside the Justice League of America in 3 issues of Brave and the Bold. While this is the first time we learn of the Guardians, it is a concept that John Broom had used in a previous story. It comes from a Captain Comet story from Strange Adventures number 22. These Guardians aren't exactly the same, but the ones that were in that story are clearly a predecessor to the Guardians that were introduced here. And I learned that out of an issue of, I believe it was Alter Ego magazine. And I found that kind of interesting.
Very cool.
But it's just a classic origin, Hal Jordan's origin. And it's remained mostly unchanged through the years. I think the most significant changes come after Hal puts on the ring, because in the modern retellings, he's pretty much immediately taken to Oa for training and learning about the Guardians, where in these original ones, you know, he just puts on the ring and goes out about superheroing, and it's some time before he learns about the Guardians.
In a lot of ways, that's got to be a good thing, though, because when you first go to Oa and you meet, say, for instance, the rest of the Green Lantern Corps, it's helpful to have characters that have already had some sort of a story, as opposed to just, here's 100 aliens in one picture. You don't know any of them. And in fact, you know, a lot of them are going to end up looking the same because, you know, we can only think of so many different kinds of aliens.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of a slow introduction, which is with as dense as this is going to become it pretty quickly, that's a much better way for children of the 60s to enter into this world.
But the only other comment I had was that I like the art. Hal looks a little scrawny in places, but I think who did the art on this one? Gil Kane? Yeah, Gil Kane and Murphy Anderson's art is pretty good throughout the story. And that's really all I had on it.
Okay, I did go through sort of point by point, but I only have a few points to discuss. First off, I did find it amusing that when Hal's, you know, astral image, whatever it is, appeared on Oa, and he was unconscious, his Earth body was unconscious, that he was in the middle of flying a plane. And he doesn't know yet that he's just going to return as though it was a brain fart. Don't you think he'd be a little bit like, hey, guys, I'm in the middle of flying a plane, and it's going to crash, and I'm going to die. Could you send me back? I mean, I've had dreams like that where I realize that I'm in a dream and then wonder, wait, I wonder where I am. I hope I'm not behind the wheel.
Well, I thought the astral thing was his physical body continued.
Right. It was,
right. So, and it's in a plane that is flying along.
But he has consciousness in the plane, is my understanding.
Okay. My understanding was that all this happens like in the blink of an eye.
Okay. Yeah.
The actual meeting with the Guardians, talking to them, learning from them, that it just happens in the blink of an eye. So if his memory has been wiped, just goes, oh, what was that?
Oh, dear. I started nose barreling towards the ground.
Jumping ahead, because I didn't have a lot more to say about the origin. I think we said a lot about that. Page 9, I don't get why they're erasing this from his mind. I mean, I sort of mentioned that. And then they decide that they should warn him about a coming danger after they let him go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that.
Oh, yeah. We should have done that. Why did we erase his mind? I erased too much. Darn it. But I also get a huge kick out of how Carol Ferris, it has to be explained how she became a woman boss, because it's 1960.
Yeah, it's 1960. And
like, she's a woman and she's the boss. But I know that's hard to swallow, but let me just explain real quick.
There's this thing.
And it's because her father is gallivanting all over the world or something and left her in charge of Ferris Air as long as she didn't become romantically entangled. Like, that was the deal breaker. Page 10, this is the first time that the invisibility shield was used on the power battery.
Oh, yeah? They didn't use that in the old Showcase? In the Showcase that's, issues?
That's what I read. I did not backtrack through those Showcase issues, but that it was the first time that was used. And actually, the next story we're going to talk about, the ring is going to be used to make people invisible.
Yeah.
For an extended period of time.
Invisible.
Yeah. But yeah, Hal thinks the battery is talking to him, and you know, nobody's going to argue with that, because when something's
inanimate is talking to you, you just say, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead. Page 14, it's interesting how much more complex the constructs will become, but they're not now. Like right now, it's basically a ring beam. He can make a force field for and there's flight and space travel. He can use it for communication. And there's this ring beam. We have not seen that much in the way of complex constructs. But he does create a nozzle to spray liquid. It's liquid oxygen at these guys, or a drig rather. And also, I don't know if he's converting the oxygen that might be in the air of the planet, or if he's literally creating frozen liquid oxygen.
I've seen kind of debates on that too, even with the modern stories, whether the ring will actually create an item or just create an item that's like it.
Yeah,
well,
fair enough.
It can manipulate atoms because if, and I know this isn't canon, but if you watched Emerald Knights, Abin Sur is actually able to recreate metal for Atrocitus's cage.
Okay.
So I think they can at the atomic level, but it would take a lot of skill, and I don't think Hal has that skill yet.
Yeah, my best guess is, I mean, I don't want to think that he's able to create oxygen with the ring, but if he can pull oxygen out of the air, assuming that it is an oxygen-rich planet, which I'll go ahead and just guess that it is, that's what he's doing. But it's not clear. But oh well. Yeah, the only other thing I had to say was this is the first appearance of the Guardians of the Universe, although they are just called the Guardians here.
They will become important. Those little blue guys are a pain. And see, even here they're kind of pulling rank and messing with his head.
Exactly. And wiping his memory afterwards, which is... Why? Why? Why are you doing this? But yeah, actually, I don't think they appear again until Green Lantern number 7.
Yes, that's correct.
I actually had one more note, and I know it's not about the story we looked at, but the cover, we see Hal fighting a giant puppet, which really speaks, I think, towards why Marvel Comics took off. I mean, 3 months after this issue was on the stands, we had the first issue of Fantastic Four, where on that cover, the Fantastic Four are fighting a giant monster breaking forth from the street. And here we have Green Lantern fighting a puppet. And that's...
Yeah, but remember that even then, Marvel took a good couple of decades to actually start to beat DC.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, for every... I think even at that point, DC was outselling Marvel by something like 10 to 1.
But at the same time, if you go to the newsstand and you see the cover to Fantastic Four number 1 with the giant mole creature, and then... Green Lantern fighting a giant puppet. Which way are you going to go?
Right,
right. And what both were doing were creating a brand recognition, and DC was much more easily recognized than Marvel for just about everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't say that as a slam against DC because I'm a DC guy. I prefer DC to Marvel in just about any area. But the point I was trying to get across is that it's an example of just how different the companies were. Yeah. And why I think Marvel kind of grabbed a market that if this wasn't appealing to a reader, you know, the Marvel book would have.
It's kind of funny that you mentioned that because I'm much more of a DC than a Marvel, yet my all-time favorite era for comic books in total, all of them, would be Marvel in the 1960s.
Hmm. No, I'll give you that. I can see that because I've been covering Hulk and – course he crosses over. That was some really rich, really out of nowhere quality at the time. Nobody had seen anything like that.
Exactly. And that's a testament to who Stan Lee is. And not that we need to turn this episode into a love letter to Stan Lee, but he's just such an excellent storyteller. And the fact that you can have those stories and that when you do try to mess with the origins, that when you try to go away from what Stan Lee had actually done, it almost always fails.
Are you referring to John Byrne's reboot?
Is that the Batman – or not Batman, Spider-Man. It's not year one. Chapter one.
Yeah, that was John Byrne. Great Superman writer, but not so good at Spider-Man.
Yeah, John Byrne to me is 50-50.
Yeah, completely hit or miss. But this is not a John Byrne podcast.
In fact, I don't think we're ever going to be talking about John Byrne stuff on a Green Lantern podcast, are we?
He wrote that Gantlet's Tale with Larry Niven, but that's a ways down the road.
That's a long way down the road. Yeah. I'd forgotten about that.
We're not going to cover the other story in this issue, but I did look at the letters page, and I noticed there's a letter from Roy Thomas, which I found interesting.
Oh, really?
I assume it's Roy Thomas, former DC and Marvel writer and alter ego editor, because it says Roy Thomas, Jackson, Missouri, and I'm pretty sure Roy Thomas grew up in Missouri.
Really?
Or lived in Missouri for a while.
I live in Missouri. Hey! He did live in Missouri. You're right, now that I think about it, because I remember
it's amazing where people can live nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that, because he mentioned that I think it was an introduction to something. In any number of my myriad of Superman books here, which I'm not going to search through.
So we ready to move on to the next issue?
Yes, that is Green Lantern number 7, which has a cover date of July, August 1961. Approximate on-sale date was May 23rd of 1961. Editor was Julia Schwartz. This is The Day 100,000 People Vanished, written by John Broom, penciled by Gil Kane, inked by Joe Giella. It was reprinted in DC Special number 8, DC Special Blue Ribbon Digest number 15, Green Lantern Archives Volume 2 hardcover, Showcase Presents Green Lantern Volume 1 trade paperback, Green Lantern In Brightest Day trade paperback, The Green Lantern Chronicles Volume 2, and Green Lantern Omnibus hardcover. And the story kicks in precisely at 14 minutes after 9 a.m. on a bright morning in the thriving community of Valdale in the West Coast. People get gas, talk on the street, bustle their way to work, and then there's an odd shimmering, like the air in the air, like rain of light. And then a thunderclap, and at exactly 9:15 a.m., the 100,000 people who lived in Valdale vanish, making it an instant ghost town. Back at Ferris Airfield, Green Lantern, a.k.a. Hal Jordan, returns from examining the town, and Thomas Kalmaku – is there an official way to say that?
I've always pronounced it Kalmaku.
Kalmaku will work.
Yeah. I've always pronounced it Pie Face.
I was going to leave that out. Yeah. The Green Lantern's confidant and friend asks if Hal found out what happened. Hal hasn't found a single clue, but he did realize on his way back that the disappearance took place a little after 9 o'clock. Which is relevant because it just so happens he was supposed to be in Valdale to take part in an opening ceremony, but he had to finish up a case he was working on, because it's all about Hal. So had he made his appointment at the Valdale boys' home, he too would have vanished. And for an instant while talking to Thomas, Green Lantern's mind goes blank, and unknown to Hal, an energy duplicate of himself flies through the space all the way to Oa to stand before the Guardians. The Guardians warn of a danger threatening Hal. Hey, they actually remembered that he's going to be there this time. And they tell the tale of Sinestro. Their one mistake. In Sector 1417, on the planet of Korugar, they bestowed a ring and a battery on a being known as Sinestro, which should have been a red flag to begin with, but this actually went well for a while, and Sinestro actually kept evil down in his sector, but the power went to Sinestro's head. And he decided that his secret chamber wasn't enough. He built this opulent headquarters that outshined every building on Korugar. And instead of proactively seeking out evil, Sinestro would have citizens line up with their requests as he sat on a throne and he only took cases that interested him. When one of the Korugarians actually stood up and called Sinestro out, he got a power beam to the face, knocking him unconscious. And Sinestro went as far to dissolve the High Council, essentially becoming the dictator of the planet. The Guardians caught wind of this during a periodic check-in, so they brought Sinestro to Oa. And did they mention Oa in Green Lantern number 1? Or did they even mention it here?
Oh, yes, they did.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They mentioned it in a text box to explain where Hal Jordan was.
Gotcha. I didn't catch that. But they bring him, Sinestro, to Oa, and they strip him of his insignia, his ring, his battery, and then they banish him to the antimatter universe of Quard. And they thought that sending Sinestro out of the universe would end his menace, but they were wrong again. Count that. That's two times. So they made two mistakes, not one.
And don't forget the Manhunters.
Well, yeah, there's that. That's That's just kind of one big mistake.
And didn't they lose all their women one time?
I don't. Well, okay, we can nitpick the Guardians all day, but the Guardians tell Hal that they have no power in the antimatter universe, but they can peer into it. And when they did, they found Sinestro determined to become master of that world as well. And Sinestro has joined with the Guardians, convincing them that the reason they haven't destroyed the Green Lanterns is because they just aren't evil enough. And he taught them to get in touch with their inner evil and creates a truly evil mechanism. Those are his words. The Viso Teleporter that transports people to Quard. All Sinestro has to do is switch it on, and at the right moment, such as when, you know, Green Lantern is in Valdale, they will all be in their clutches. Hal reasons that this explains what happened in Valdale, and if he escaped accident by not going there. And the Guardians tell Hal that he has to stop Sinestro and do it alone, since their jurisdiction doesn't extend to Quard, which makes total sense. And we can't go there, but you can. Well, he's under your power. Does he have jurisdiction that you don't?
Really? Can you send people there as punishment?
That's true. Yeah. It's a little backwards. I think they just want to mess with Hal. They're too lazy to do it. But they send Hal back to Earth, allowing him to keep his memories this time. So now he does know about the Guardians. And once back on Earth, Green Lantern begins looking for a way into Quard to defeat Sinestro and find out what happened to the 100,000 people who vanished in Valdale. Hal flies out to the surrounding desert to an inter-universe aperture, which he used to enter Quard once before, and it is gone. Side note, that actually happened in issue number 2 of Green Lantern. He fought a weaponer of Quard. So that's what Sinestro was referring to when he said, "You haven't defeated Green Lantern yet." And Hal thinks to himself that there is one other way to get into Quard. It's tricky and dangerous, but he's got to try it. Hal goes back to Coast City and turns every living being invisible with his ring, protecting them from the Viso Teleporter. And he stands in the middle of the street, making himself a prime target for Sinestro. And sure enough, Hal hears the familiar thunderclap, and an incredible force seizes him. And as Hal vanishes, the citizens of Coast City become visible again. Hal appears in the antimatter universe of Quard, where evil is the standard of behavior. That's the text box. And the Quardians immediately attack Hal, who deflects their advances. Sinestro, however, threatens to destroy all the citizens of Valdale if Hal doesn't surrender. And Hal surrenders under the terms that Sinestro releases the citizens of Valdale. So Sinestro agrees, complimenting Hal on his bargain of 1 for 100,000. And after the return of the people of Valdale, Sinestro places Hal in a yellow energy bubble. Now keep in mind, Sinestro doesn't have his ring yet, which I thought was curious, but that's a note. Sorry. And he tells Hal that he knows the Green Lantern ring will protect Hal automatically even when he's not conscious. So Hal will remain in the yellow energy until the clock strikes 6, which will mark 24 hours since Hal last charged his ring, and they will destroy him then. And Hal is seemingly helpless, but notes that the clock on the wall works on the vibration of atomic particles, and the ring has been receiving its impulses. And so the final moment arrives at 6 o'clock, and Hal is released from the bubble because he poses no threat without a charged-up ring. Sinestro readies a gun, pointing it at Hal, who surprises the villain with a green energy attack, knocking him down. Sinestro says that this is impossible, and Hal explains that the ring couldn't pierce the bubble, but the carbon dioxide from his breath could, and he just controlled the CO2 bubbles and had them speed up the atomic mechanism of the clock to make it run fast. And Hal creates a giant green wave to wipe out the Guardians, encases Sinestro in a permanent green bubble, and then exits the antimatter universe through the aperture, which he can actually open on this side. And after a quick charge of his ring, which only had seconds left, he shows up at the postponed opening of the Valdale Boys Settlement House, wrapping up the story by giving the awestruck kids a speech about how they can overcome any evil when right is on their side.
And then they all had ice cream.
Yes. Are you making a South Park reference?
I just listened today to the Jeffrey and Michaels from Crisis to Crisis where Jeffrey was talking about that episode.
I listened to it last night.
Okay. That's what I call a sticky situation.
I started last time. Who wants to go this time?
I'll go first. On page 7, when Sinestro's ring is being taken away, they also strip him of his symbol. And I liked seeing that because I think it was Jeff Johns that brought back the idea that the lanterns earn their symbol like a police badge. Mm-hmm. So it was nice seeing that it was there at the beginning as well. And on pages 10 and 14. We see that the ring in this, at this point in history can pretty much do anything. I mean, we see it manipulating CO2 molecules outside of a yellow bubble, and then the bigger item is making the entire city vanish.
Also makes julienne fries.
I think the listening to Thomas DJ's DJ Comics Cavalcade, where he covered more of these early Green Lantern stories, I think the Green Lantern ring at this point pretty much just acted like a magic wish fulfillment device. You know, in modern stories, they've put more of a, I hate to say realistic, but realistic kind of mindset to it, where here it could just do anything.
Who needs the powers of the Spectre? I have a 1960s Green Lantern ring.
But this was a really great story. I mean, it had its share of Silver Age goofiness, but I really enjoyed it. And I kept hearing Vic Perrin's voice for Sinestro, especially during the monologue on page 15. Perrin was the voice of Sinestro in the Super Friends cartoon before Don Messick took over the role.
Ooh.
But yeah, this is the first appearance of Sinestro, and I think his origin has changed a little more over the years than Hal's, but it still retains the same basic idea of that he was a Green Lantern, and then the power went to his head, and he was kicked out of the Corps. As David mentioned, Sinestro has no yellow power ring here. He gets one when he returns in issue number 9, but that ring is destroyed at the end of the story, and I don't know when he latches onto the permanent one. So if anyone knows, be sure to write in. Let us know.
I'll go ahead and jump on next. First off, I thought this cover was kind of weird.
Yeah.
It's not a cover that if I saw it on the newsstand, I would immediately say, "Oh, I've got to pick this one up." When in fact, you know, when he's fighting a clown puppet, I'm kind of curious. Here, it just looks like he's X-raying people, and that woman is like, "How dare you see me in X-rayed?" Whatever.
She's kind of cute too.
If you were a drawing, I suppose. Okay, my first real note, though, is I remember when I didn't know that the term pie face was incredibly racist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but I do think that it is worth mentioning. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you go back and you watch old Disney cartoons or old Warner Brothers cartoons, and they generally don't try to show you the really racist ones anymore, but you can find them.
Song of the South, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But moving ahead a little bit, page 3.
While we're on that note,
yeah.
You know, I understand that pie face is a racist term, but if at some point in the show I accidentally say pie face in reference to Tom, please no one think it's a racist slur on my point. It's just I've, you know, reading these old stories, I got used to the character being called that before, like Jeffrey said, before we realized it was a racist term. And I don't even really think it was used in a racist connotation back when these were written. Because, I mean, that's what they call the character well into the future. So,
yeah, and in fact, I fully intend to continue calling him Pie Face.
Well, there you go. But,
well, I mean, it's within context. Keep it in context.
Exactly.
Right,
that's
right,
what
it right.
was called.
However, if I do get annoyed with him, I will say Pie Face. But we'll see what happens. On page 3, I'm thinking to myself that Hal shouldn't worry so much. I mean, that was just a brain fart when
that's
he...
Sushi. Yeah,
he had some bad sushi. But seriously, it's at this point that I'm just not liking this whole astral form energy duplicate stuff. I much prefer. I don't know exactly how long it takes until they start saying, you know what, just come on over to Oa. Just fly on over. We're right here.
Well, Brew might have been thinking that he would have to have a ship to travel to Oa, since Eben Sur was in a ship to come to Earth.
Yeah, and that's another thing that's kind of weird that we didn't talk about, that he's in a ship when, in fact, I mean, later on that in that same story, Hal flew to another planet. And they are saying that it is within his own sector, so it can't be necessarily that far away. And Oa could be, you know, billions of light years away.
Yeah, it says it's in the central galaxy of the universe.
Exactly. So that might be the reason. Maybe they are trying to put a little bit of semi-realistic physics into it, just that it really would be too far. But eventually, you know, the Green Lanterns are able to fly very, very quickly, and they can go from one end of the universe to the other. But, I mean, on the other hand, he could always just ask to get a ride with Superman.
Right.
who can literally fly from one end of the universe to the other in a blink of an eye at this point, and he can blow out a star with his super breath. I have to imagine that it was abandoned for a reason. Because eventually it will be abandoned. I just don't know exactly when. Okay, Sinestro's problem, the way that they describe it is that he had a weakness in his brain. Interesting.
So he's mentally challenged.
I didn't know if that meant that or just sort of a...
I didn't take it that way, but...
Just sort of a disorder in his personality.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but it's described specifically as a weakness in his brain.
True.
So, yeah, I thought maybe we'd have a little bit more to discuss with that, but no, I mean, it is pretty straightforward. page 7. If you really wanted to punish Sinestro, you don't send him to the antimatter universe. You send him back to Korugar without his ring and let the lynch mobs take care of it.
Yeah, I had a note on that as well.
And another thing I have to call BS on, a Guardian says that they can only peer into Quard to see what's going on. They just sent Sinestro there.
I didn't catch that.
Like, it just happened. So, yeah, the Guardians are, you know, notorious liars. That's
well, yeah,
what their thing is.
At least they're establishing it early.
Exactly. Page 8, I can't help but giggle when supervillains gloat about being more evil than each other. No, I'm more evil than you. No, I'm the evil one. And even better when the machine is evil too.
The whole scene reminded me of Austin Powers.
And you're Evil Pet Zoo?
Yeah, you're the Diet Coke of evil, not quite evil enough.
page 10. Yeah, it was at that point when I said, wait, he can make people invisible for like X amount of time? And I thought it would be really funny if he, like, you know, just missed a cat or something and he shows up a cat next to him. Page 13, the weaponers look quite a bit different here than they will later on.
Yeah, they look like just normal Caucasian humans.
With Caucasian weird, Lex Luthers.
With weird clothes, yeah.
Page 14... comic book physics. Gotta love comic book physics, because he's Hal figures out, because he's like the ultimate physicist here, figures out that even though he's trapped in this thing, that he can slow down time, or not actually slow down time, but slow down the clock, or speed up the clock rather, by getting some of the CO2 in his breath to go out through, and that will slow down the clock. Now, I can just imagine it. It's 1960. You get some 8-year-old who's just read this, and they sit down in front of like the grandfather clock in the living room and just breathe on it for hours and hours and hours. And then their parents wonder why they wonder why their parents don't want them reading comic books.
Or they lock themselves into a refrigerator thinking they can get themselves out that way.
Well, yeah, but without that, David Copperfield wouldn't have a career.
True.
Yeah. I love the plastic bags that say, this bag is not a toy. I'm like, well, it is if you play with it. So, yeah, just really funny comic book physics here. But then page 15, this is the best part. This is like the weirdest punishment ever. He creates a construct around Sinestro that will – it's made with his green ring, and it's just going to last forever. So he's stuck in there. He's never going to be able to come out forever and ever and ever. Now, I got to wonder two things. If Hal's ring ever runs out of juice, like if he does run it down to zero at some point, is it going to disappear at that point when he goes many, many light years away? Well, I mean, he's in another universe right now, essentially, the antimatter universe. When he comes back to the regular universe, does his willpower still power that specific construct? If he takes a nap at some point, is it at that point going to go away? But no, actually, the big question in my mind is, what if he says to one of the weaponers, hey, man, I want to get out of here. You got a yellow toothpick?
The ring's only got a range of about 30 feet, so as soon as Hal goes in the next room, it's not going to work anymore.
Sinestro's laughing so hard. Like, oh no, this is the worst punishment ever. Don't hurt. Bye. And that's it for my notes.
Okay. As far as Sinestro, this being obviously his first appearance, his visual design, I didn't know this. It's actually based on David Niven, who he was the the nemesis in Pink Panther.
I didn't know that.
Yep. Somebody told me that a long time ago, but I'd forgotten, so thank you for reminding me.
Yep. And I think Ethan Van Sciver draws him as Hitler, but that's a little bit different. But in general, this story sort of proves that most of our major villains, with very few exceptions, their first appearances are usually pretty lame.
Yeah.
Look at Green Goblin for a really good example. He lures Spider-Man to the desert under the pretense of making a fake movie. No joke. But Sinestro, as far as a concept, he is Darth Vader. He predates Darth Vader. He's pretty much the Jedi that fell and became kind of the ultimate evil. And of course, he's an analog for the devil in the Bible. And that's why he's red, I assume.
Abin Sur is red too.
True. But as far as page by page, on page 2, if you look at that last panel, everybody's disappears. Even though those cars are at a stoplight, they're in gear. Why is there no chaos once these people disappear? It's all perfectly calm.
Because those cars are really, really heavy. I mean, this is 1960. These are super heavy cars. They didn't make them lightweight, and these were huge gas guzzlers too. So it's actually too heavy for the engine that it has to even move the car unless somebody's there pressing on the gas.
Is that true, or are you just...
I don't know.
Okay. I was kind of amazed.
I don't know.
But I like how the Guardians, like, we made one mistake, and then they list about two or three right in a row. And if you look at...
He also gave you a sidekick and called him Pie Face.
Yeah, there's that. On page 5, panel 1, I almost thought, is that the same monster from the Planet of Doom Men? Is that Drigg? But he doesn't have the mohawk.
It looks like Drigg without the mohawk.
Could be from the same species.
That's what the females look like.
Oh, sweet.
That mohawk wasn't just for decoration.
Is it like Avatar where it swings down and they connect? Anyway, like on page 11, Hal says, specifically, my power ring doesn't work here. And then one panel later, he forms a force field. And then on page 13, he blasts Sinestro with it. So clearly it seems to be functioning. So I don't understand what he's meaning by that.
You're right. There were so many weird little inconsistencies. And, you know, that thing with the clock was just too funny that I completely ignored that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Wow, there are a lot of problems with this story.
Yeah, it's not the greatest Green Lantern story ever.
It's still fun, yeah.
It's a fun read, just not... I don't know that I'd put it in the greatest category.
No, in fact, I would go so far as to say that the one we're going to cover last is probably the best one out of all of them.
Oh, I'll agree completely. And that's all my notes. If we want to move on to that one.
Our third and final story we're going to look at this episode is Green Lantern number 87, with a cover date of December 1970/January 1971. It was released October 21st, 1971, for a cover price of 25 cents. Our cover is by Neil Adams, and our story is called Beware My Power. Story by Denny O'Neill, art by Neil Adams and Dick Giordano, and edited by Julie Schwartz.
And I've actually read a bunch of them in this era.
Mm-hmm.
Because, man, that Neil Adams did such an amazing job on Green Lantern, and I actually think this issue is a testament to it.
Mm. Just a quick note before I do the synopsis. Guy Gardner was introduced in Green Lantern number 59 about 3 years prior in 1968. That story was reprinted in issue 184, so we'll cover and talk about that when it comes up, probably around episode 8 if I've done my math right. But for the purposes of this story, all you need to know is that Guy was introduced and tapped as the alternate choice to be the Green Lantern of Earth should something happen to Hal. So, as we open here, Coast City is struck with an earthquake. Hal flies out as Green Lantern to help, just in time to see Guy Gardner trying to save a girl and get hit by a bus for his troubles. After taking Guy to the hospital, Hal is summoned by the Guardian, who tells him that with Guy injured, they need to select a new alternate. Later, we find ourselves on a random street corner in a, quote, urban ghetto, where John Stewart and another man are being hassled by a pair of white police officers. John returns Lip, and the cops back down. Hal protests the selection of John, but the Guardian stands firm, so Hal meets up with John and explains the situation. John replies, and I kid you not, this is the actual reply verbatim from the comic. Sure, I'll try your gig. Might be last being a superhero. My mama named me John Stewart. Square John to my friends. Only from now on, maybe you better call me Black Lantern. Because he's black.
That's hot.
Green Lantern.
Yeah.
Anyway, after a crash course on the hows and whys of the ring, the lantern, and the oath, not to mention some stereotypical angry black man remarks from John, he and Hal suit up and take to the skies for some ring-slinging practice. They soon fly over an airport where a plane has landed and decide to check things out just as a fuel truck hits an oil slick, spins out of control, and heads right towards the gathered crowd. Hal uses his ring to move the crowd out of harm's way, and John stops the truck, but causes a gush of oil to spew all over the plane's passenger, a Senator Jeremiah Clutcher. Sorry. After a racist joke from John to the senator, the two Green Lanterns fly off, and Hal chews John out for his irresponsible actions. John doesn't see what the big deal is, and makes more angry black man comments, including calling Hal Whitey. Soon, Hal's had enough and orders John to guard the senator. Later, John and Hal watch as the senator makes a speech riddled with racist comments towards, quote, the darkies. As the senator speaks, a black man pulls a pistol and fires two shots towards the senator. While John stands by, refusing to act, Hal leaps into action and is able to subdue the would-be assassin, but finds it curious that the gunman didn't try to shoot him. Out in the parking lot, another gunman takes aim at the security guard. John deflects the shot and encases the white shooter in an emerald prism. As the guard gives his thanks, Hal confronts John and begins to chew him out again, but John slaps Hal away and eventually explains that he spotted both gunmen and had deduced that the black gunman was firing blanks as a distraction while the real murder happened in the parking lot. Apparently, Clutcher had orchestrated the entire ordeal to make it look like his racist beliefs were true and make himself look like a hero. He'd hoped to capitalize on the situation in order to boost his own bid for the presidency. Shortly, Hal apologizes to John for misjudging him, and John replies that their styles might be different, but styles don't matter, and neither does color. And a narrative caption tells us, "Where or when, no man can say, but rest assured, John Green Lantern Stewart will return."
Do you mind if I start on this one?
Go ahead.
Okay. First off, I want to mention the cover. The cover is just really does set the tone for exactly what you're about to read here. It's like, they whipped the Green Lantern. Now let him try me. I mean, can you imagine a black guy saying, "I dare you to whip me"?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's.
You got to remember this was written by white people. And the fact that Jon Stewart is an angry black man really turned me off at first. But I thought that its use in the story is what made it good. Because even though it would be – it's very stereotypical here for the black character to be the angry black character. It's actually common. It was happening all the time. But in this case, number one, he's an educated guy and he is treated as somebody who is not, basically, because of the color of his skin and the assumptions that go along with that from these other characters. And the reason why I think that worked in the end is because it really looked like he was clearly not a good candidate to be a Green Lantern. But the Guardians never make mistakes.
You're
right.
And
it's just that John was just smarter than everybody else here. And John is a very smart character, as we'll see a lot of. Page two. It's mentioned that this earthquake was – luckily, the quake was slight, yet it still collapsed an overpass.
Right.
Just saying. This was – Coast City is in a lot of ways an analog for I would say, Los Angeles or as though it's part of Los Angeles in the same way that I would think of, you know, Metropolis or Gotham City as kind of being part of New York or being in that area. I think it's meant to be a bit farther up the coast, where there really aren't that many major cities right there on the coast. But they are
is
clearly...
Otisburg near there?
Yes. it's directly next... Otisburg?
It's a little bitty place.
Sorry. They do get earthquakes. There was the big one in the 1930s, and there actually was going to be another one not long after this that was going to be pretty big. But again, that's in the L.A. area. Pages 3 and 4, obviously not the guy Gardner that we know later.
No.
something happens to this guy. He gets traumatized or something.
Being hit by a bus?
Yeah, being hit by a bus will do that, certainly. Page 5. John Stewart is bad.
Is that your note?
Yep.
I agree completely.
And kind of a jerk. But then again, I mean, this cop is being a... I think that what this cop is doing is actually not necessarily that bad. And yes, it is kind of harassing people. But saying that they need a game permit to sit there and play dominoes is really going too far. But on the other hand, if they were directly in front of the door, it would be like, come on, guys, you can't do this right here. So it's really the way that the cop says it. If he had just said, you guys are blocking the sidewalk, and that's what he ends with. But instead, he's like, you haven't got a game permit. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And that's what John Stewart is responding to here. Page 6, Black Lantern. I had to mention it. You can call me Black Lantern.
Because every African-American superhero in this era had to start with the word black.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Page 9. Okay, some people call it reverse racism. I call it racism. John Stewart is a bit of a racist.
Yeah. I'd leave off the bit.
Yes. Yeah. But it goes along with the being an angry black man,
right?
Basically. I mean, that's part of the character that they're trying to set up here, as stereotypical as it is. But I just wanted to say, like, before anybody else there, like a listener says, oh, well, that's reverse racism. I just want to point out, no, calling it reverse racism is racism, just so you know.
Yeah.
Page 10, my note is, holy he actually just said that. I don't know if we're actually saying these things. I'm not sure if you have to bleep me out there or if you
I'd like to keep the language down in the show if we could.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. But yeah, I don't have a problem saying
the darkie. I mean, it's clear, you know.
I was about to say, understand, I've nothing against the darkies, but it's scientific fact that their brains are smaller than normal. Because of their limited intelligence, they can't appreciate the finer things.
It's passive-aggressive, yeah.
Yeah. The way this guy is. Man, the fact that he ended up setting himself up for this, I'm surprised somebody didn't just shoot. But on the other hand, it is 1971. And unfortunately, even politicians could still get away with that sort of thing. You can't get away with saying something that badly now. And if you say anything that's even close to it, people do get all up in arms, as mm-hmm. they should. And, you know, if you look specifically at – I'm not trying to call out at one side of politics being better than the other in any way here. But what Michelle Bachmann said about African-Americans not being or how they were better off when it was slave days and they were given, you know, 3 meals a day, whereas now if they're homeless living on the street or whatever, they're not being fed as well, which is like one of the most racist things I've ever heard. And of course she got called out about it. But I really did enjoy the ending where it looks like John is throwing in the towel and just saying, no, I'm not going to help that guy. But now we know he's a hep cat and he knows the whole deal. He knew exactly what was going on, and that's what his reaction was to. And it was my understanding of the way that his character had been developed up to this point that led me to believe that, yeah, he was doing exactly that, throwing in the towel. So really, I'm just as bad as Hal Jordan here for having read it and thought of it that way until it was made clear to me.
Yeah, I kind of did the same thing, and I actually had a note because I do notes as I'm actually reading the book, and I had to go back and scratch it out.
You want to go ahead with your notes next, David?
Oh, yeah, I could do that. I kind of – a lot of – Jeffrey covered a lot of it. I like that Guy Gardner wasn't always a complete jerk, and I like when he's not written as through and through jerk because he may be rough around the edges. He may tick you off. He may push your buttons, but Guy will do the right thing
right.
given the chance.
Definitely.
Even if it's for the wrong reasons, he will. He'll come through. I'm not sure when the Corps started appointing alternates, though.
I think that – what was it, Green Lantern 68? I think that was the first – or no, 59, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was in it was in 1968.
Oh, there you go. I think that was the first time.
Yeah, and you kind of hit it on the head, Jeffrey. There's a lot of – he makes a Tar Baby reference in – John does, which comes from Uncle Remus stories, which Song of the South is based on. So the senator gets oil sprayed on his face, and he makes a picking cotton joke.
Yeah.
And I mean – this is a different time. I think this was a something that needed to happen at this time, even if it was the intentions were good, but you know, some of the execution was a little bit off. But this book at this time was extremely culturally relevant. When you look at 85 and 86, that was the Speedy story. So we just came off that.
Yeah, that came a couple issues before this.
Mm-hmm. 85 and 86. It was okay. A two-parter. So this was a book that at this time was saying things that A, needed to be said, and B, no other book, no other television shows. Well, you had All in the Family hadn't come out yet. Yeah, this was saying things that needed to be said. It was very, of course, Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams, they're well known for this run for a reason. But I like, as Jeffrey said, I like that John shows his actual true valor. Yeah, I mean, he's still doing the right thing. Hal is kind of the jerk in this situation because, I mean, I came into John later with his how he was presented in Mosaic. And this isn't negated by the John we know later down the line. But you don't see as much of that side of him. And they actually don't mention that he was a veteran either. I guess, wouldn't the war have been going on at this time? That weird DC sliding rule thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would have to be the sliding rule thing. They do mention that he's an architect, though, and that's something that they always stick with.
Yes. And that makes sense to the way the rings would operate down the line. But, yeah, this was a...
Yeah, but that's really like a John Sven Skyver construct.
True.
which I like, and I wish that an earlier team had done that, because it's really great. It's probably my favorite thing to come out of that era.
That the he era was an that, architect. That still, that...
No, just I mean the era that we're currently in. That different lanterns have different ways that their constructs work. And John is an architect, so his appear to be built, and like every single, it's explained that every single bolt has a purpose in a construct that he might build.
And it makes sense that the rings would not necessarily take on the personality of the wearer, but operate different depending on who's wearing them. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. But that was all the notes I had. I mean, just the cultural relevance on this book was amazing. And like Jeffrey said, this was probably the best book we've been looking at this episode.
I had never read this story before reading it to cover it for the show. Oddly enough, my first major exposure to Jon Stewart was in the Justice League cartoon. I'd read him in comics before that, but never more than just a random guest appearance or a crossover. Later, he joined the JLA and has appeared a lot more in recent years in the Green Lantern titles, so I'm more familiar with his comic book counterpart now. But, wow, this is just a completely different portrayal of John than anything I've seen. And I'm really glad that we've moved beyond this, because this type of portrayal of John has no place in modern stories. Jeffrey and David already hit a lot of points that I could make. I totally understand what Denny O'Neill was trying to say with the story, and I know that 1971 was a very different time, both socially and culturally, but this is just a very heavy-handed story, and I could take it apart in a lot of places for that, but I think doing that might lead to a discussion we don't really want on the first episode. So, you know, the primary reason we're looking at this is for the first appearance of John, so I'm just going to say that his portrayal here is very different, and I'm glad we've moved on from that, both as a character and as a society. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, as a society, I mean, in a lot of ways we have moved on from it. But on the other hand, I look back, this is actually still a ways back at this point. But, you know, Die Hard with a Vengeance in 1994, Samuel L. Jackson played a very similar kind of character.
Yeah.
Like, again, some people might call it reverse racism, but, you know, it's racism. But he was racist against white people.
If you were to introduce Jon Stewart into the books today, he wouldn't be portrayed like this.
No.
No, not at all.
Yeah. But I really like the art. I mean, the art is beautiful. That opening splash is nice. Page 7, when Hal and John are flying through the air, and Hal is doing zigzags through the air and flips, and John has a more smoother path. I really like that. It was nice stuff. Anybody else got any more comments on this particular story?
I think that's it. I think we pretty much covered it.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't give the reprint information at the beginning, so it was reprinted in Green Lantern Green Arrow number 6, which was a series that I don't remember. I think it came out around the time that we're going to be starting our regular coverage.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Okay, it reprinted a lot of these stories. And then there was the Green Lantern Green Arrow Collection Volume 2, Green Lantern Green Arrow Collection Hardcover, The Greatest Green Lantern Stories Ever Told, Trade Paperback, and Showcase Presents Green Lantern Volume 5.
I think that the greatest Green Lantern stories ever told, I think all three of the ones that we've discussed are in there. So if you're looking for a place to pick those up, that's probably a good place to start.
Was the Sinestro one? The Sinestro one wasn't.
It wasn't? Okay.
No.
It wasn't a very great story, so.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all three in the Showcase volumes. The two stories you guys did were in Volume 1 and mine was in Volume 5, so. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us this time. Next episode, we'll start our regular coverage by looking at Green Lantern number 172, 173, and 174. So we hope you'll come back for that. Anybody got any final comments before we say goodbye?
I wanted to say that you know, different people are going to love different Green Lanterns. That's just kind of how it comes down. If you grew up with Kyle Rayner, then that's the Green Lantern that you're probably going to, you know, want to cling to the most. And if you grew up with Hal Jordan, you probably want to cling to that the most. I do know that a lot of people did kind of grow up with Jon Stewart, specifically because he was the Green Lantern in Justice League Unlimited, which was a hugely popular show, not just with comic book fans. And in fact, there are people who I would wear a Green Lantern shirt, and I remember one time, like, somebody saying to me, like, why would you wear a shirt about a black guy?
Wow.
Yeah.
Which was wrong on many levels.
Wow. Who would think? Anyway, I'm not going to get into the social discussion.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of appalled by that. No, I agree with Jeffrey. I mean, everybody's got their own Green Lantern. I've been in arguments about Kyle versus Hal. And sometimes on you know, switching sides, because I like them both. But I think the idea, the core idea, rather than the character, is the important thing about Green Lantern.
Yeah. And we're not here to debate who the better character is. And we're going to read through these stories and evaluate them for what they are and celebrate the stories.
But we will all agree that Kilowog is the best.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, no.
Chip.
Nord. Chip. Nord.
All right, everybody. Well, my name is Michael Bradley, and for Jeffrey Taylor and J. David Weider, we will see you next time.
Keep the light burning.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weider. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then,
in brightest day,
in blackest night,
no evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware our power.
Green Lantern's light.